Today, I'm joined in the writer's studio by Coco Mellors, author of one of the biggest selling novels of the year here at Shakespeare and Company, Cleopatra and Frankenstein. It's a story of a woman and a man, Cleo and Frank, who meet in New York on New Year's Eve 2006, who fall in love despite, or perhaps because of, their very many differences, and whose marriage within months causes not only an earthquake in their own lives, but also sends disruptive aftershocks out into the lives of their friends and families. Coco Mellors has an exquisitely keen eye for the dynamics of relationships, how they warp under pressure over time, and how our hopes and dreams for them come into violent contact with the very real and often very damaged people at their core. She's also a master of the ebb and flow of conversations, from the way we flirt to the way we bond and, of course, to the way we fight. All of which makes Cleopatra and Frankenstein one of the most devilishly readable debuts of the year. Coco, welcome to the Shakespeare and Company podcast.
Thank you so much. That's such a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Let's begin at the beginning when we first meet Cleo and Frank. Now, we are going to go a lot into their characters, I suspect, in this conversation. Mm-hmm. So we won't go into that right now. What I'd like you to do is, for listeners who may not have read the book yet, could you tell us where each of them are in their lives at the moment they meet each other on 31st of December 2006?
Yes. So Cleo and Frank, who are the titular characters in the novel, they are Cleopatra and Frankenstein. Those are their nicknames to each other. They meet on New Year's Eve, as you said, and they're at very different places in their lives. Cleo is in her 20s. She's been living in New York doing a master's for art, and her visa is just about to run out. Mm-hmm. She's from England originally, and she wants to stay in America. Frank is in his mid-40s. He's very established. He is American. He's born and raised in the city. He owns his own company. He's a successful advertiser. He's very confident. He sort of has the esteem of someone who has real financial security. And they meet each other and they have this like instant and electrifying chemistry that's completely undeniable. And the other kind of has what each one wants. You know, Cleo's looking for security. And I think Frank, in a not unusual turn, is very attracted to like the youth and beauty of this young person he's met, who may be her passion, her curiosity, her kind of youthful and perhaps slightly quixotic confidence is very exciting to him and injects his life with this sort of new vitality.
Yeah. Let's get into the writing of that first scene and how, I guess, in a sense, how you met Cleo and Frank. Because one thing that really struck me when I was reading it was just how powerfully you capture that moment of when two people who, you know, maybe they're going to have a relationship, maybe they're just going to sleep together, maybe it's going to be the love of their life, or it's going to be something short. But that moment of connection that two strangers can have seems so perfectly captured on the page. Would you just be able to talk a little bit about the process for you as a writer of channeling that connection? Was it writing from kind of personal experience remembered or some other approach?
Oh, I'm so glad that it feels, you know, that it felt like a powerful opening, because obviously the first chapter is so important in a novel, and this wasn't the initial first chapter. Mm-hmm. So even though the reader reads it first, I wrote this scene probably when I'd been working on the book for 3 or 4 years.
Wow.
So even though Cleo and Frank are just meeting each other for the first time, I knew each of them extremely well at that point, which I think was really helpful, actually, because there's so much subtext in this scene. When I was writing it, the original first chapter is a wedding scene where we meet Cleo, Frank, and all of their friends and family. Okay. And I ended up feeling it was too overwhelming for the reader, because it's just too many people to meet in one go, and I wanted to feel grounded in their relationship. So I went back and I tried to imagine, I'm always thinking how I can turn the dial up in terms of the drama of a scene. So I you know, New Year's Eve felt like a perfect setting, just, it's a new beginning. It's a kind of, it's a raucous night already. There's a lot of energy.
It's also a night which is really full of hope, which is so often disappointing.
Yes. And Frank even says that, he says, I've never, ever had a New Year's Eve that wasn't just okay. You know, it's never really exceeded his expectations. And when I was writing this meeting, I really wanted to have this feeling in the dialogue where your heart starts to beat faster as you're listening to them. They have this very quick back and forth. So I listened to this song. I often listen to one song on repeat when I'm working on a scene. And I listened to a song that had a very quick drum beat that was pitter-patter, pitter-patter. So it would go, and I would try to write the dialogue in time with that. So there's this feeling as they're like sparring back and forth. Like, hopefully you have the sensation in your own body as you're reading it. It's sort of like your pulse is going faster. Like your body is sort of electrified by what's happening. And so by the end of that chapter, we should feel like we've just fallen in love. You know, it's a big leaping off point for the rest of the book.
It's definitely one of those moments that I think, and there's another one which we'll come on to talk about later, I think, where if you've lived anything similar to that, and like, you know, whether it might have been different in intensity, it might have been different in, you know, the where and when it happened, but you kind of, you can feel your way into the scene because it feels so authentic in a way. Also in that first scene, it's the first time they get these nicknames for each other. So you know, Cleo becomes Cleopatra and Frank becomes Frankenstein. Should we, as readers, perhaps have taken that as a warning that they're, let's say that in a way they were kind of projecting something on to the other one, something of perhaps a kind of a mythological or something fictional onto the other one, which perhaps they would never quite be able to match up to.
Yeah, I think that's a good insight into that moment. You know, I was thinking, my mum is the one who actually titled the book for me. I had loads of different titles and none of them felt quite right. And she said, from reading that first chapter, how about Cleopatra and Frankenstein? And I was like, yes, it's perfect because it's this odd couple, this kind of odd sounding words together. And it's also, yes, it's about mythologies and stories and masks, you know, the version of ourselves we show someone before we let them see the real person behind. I think a lot, when I was working on this book, I thought a lot about that Baldwin quote, love takes off the mask we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live within.
Okay.
I think this story is really about that. Like, they both have these masks that they fear they cannot live without, which is, for Frank, this like kind of smooth, cool operator who has everything under control, financially supports everyone in his life. For Cleo, this like young, free artist who's got the whole world ahead of her. But they cannot keep living within those smooth facades because they're false. You know, both of them are hiding from their past, which are pretty deeply traumatized. Both of them have very real fear of intimacy, fear of love.
Yeah.
And the whole novel is about those masks cracking, those identities kind of tumbling down.
There's also something I think in that first scene, which is again something I imagine a lot of listeners will identify with at the beginning of relationships, where you have that very genuine moment of connection. And then I guess it's not exactly doubts creep in, but there's this moment of kind of the image you suddenly want to project. And I guess the mask you want to put on for the new person, how you want them to see you and how you want them to think of you in a way. And that seems to be like the case immediately for Cleo and Frank, that they are sort of, the image that came to mind as I was thinking about it was sort of, they are staking out the grounds of their relationship.
Yeah.
And bearing in mind, as you said, that, you know, they are in two very different positions in their life and with very different expectations about what will come in the next few years, it becomes very clear to the reader, I guess, that this is a kind of terrain being staked out, which will at some point be fiercely fought over.
Yes, very much so. And I think, you know, when you first meet someone, I think part of the pleasure is, I don't want to call it a full self exactly, but it's like you are your sort of shiniest self at the beginning.
Yeah.
And there's something really lovely about occupying that self for a while. It's just sort of like it's a freshness. You're like, and you get to kind of fall in love with yourself, you know, the version of you reflected in the eyes of this other person. And I think, you know, Cleo and Frank take that to an extreme. You know, they're people who feel the need to be very shiny to each other and to others. And I think because they both fear that just beneath the surface, they're deeply damaged and unlovable. Yeah. And that's kind of what they have in common. Mm-hmm. You know, ultimately, even though they're very different, they kind of are overcoming a lot of the same problems throughout the novel. And I do think the unconscious, like, I learned in my own life, like when I'm really deeply and instantly attracted to someone, I probably need to run the other way because that's really not the healthiest person for me to be around. And I think Cleo Frank learned that as well.
Yeah. You put me in mind of something, and if you'll excuse the sort of the vulgarity of it, but a story I read years ago of this woman who was hospitalized with some sort of, you know, with gut pain. And it turned out she'd been with this guy for 6 months and had never farted in front of him. And because they spent so much time together, it had been, you know, it had actually left her to the point of being hospitalized. And that always seemed to be like a great sort of metaphor for like this these early moments of relationships. Yes. If you try and put up too much of a front, then yes. you know, you end up exploding with gas.
Yes. And it will truly backfire. You know?
Oh God. There you go. That's what this was groping for, and we got there. Well done. you described their lives. So Frank, as you say, in his mid-40s, Coco in her early mid-20s. Very different status, I guess, mm-hmm. you know, in how the world would see them. And yet the power dynamic isn't perhaps as one-sided as certainly Cleo sometimes seems to think it is, and sometimes seems to tell Frank it is, and indeed vice versa. When you were getting to know these characters and getting to know their relationships, did you feel as a writer that the power of the relationship laid more with one of them than the other, or did it feel more evenly balanced?
Actually, I didn't, because I think for me, like, that would have been a moral judgment in a way of the characters, and that's not a helpful way for me to sort of to get into character. You know, in some ways, I think maybe a more straightforward way to have written this book would have been just from Cleo's perspective, mm-hmm. you know, like the young female character who obviously seems on the surface the most aligned with me. But I was very interested in also writing Frank's perspective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I write from I write from seven different perspectives mm-hmm. over the course of this book, from their other friends and family and between men and women and many different ages. And so I think there's a kind of almost easy way of writing that relationship, where it's like it's an older man being predatory towards a younger woman. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a young woman who's this currency of youth and attractiveness mm-hmm. that is very briefly granted to women
yeah.
and is not really power, but feels like power in mm-hmm. the moment, but is very illusory. And Cleo does discover that being desired is not the same as having actual real world power the way that Frank does.
Yeah.
You know, she says in the second half of the novel, you have the citizenship, you have the mm-hmm. money, you have the career, you have the apartment. And those are very real things.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And what does Cleo have? Potential, mm-hmm. you know, the ability to attract.
Yeah.
That's a slightly passive form of power, and it's also one that won't last forever. But I wanted Frank, it wouldn't be interesting for me to write like a bad guy and a sure. good girl, you know, like that's not true. Mm-hmm. And actually they're both complicated, and they both benefited from the relationship, and they were both hurt by the
yeah.
relationship.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think for me that's just a more realistic way of telling stories, mm. a more like compassionate way of telling story. I think if you're writing characters that you don't like and you want to punish them, it's never going to be a great reading experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's a really interesting thought, actually, is that idea of sort of how I guess how society might perceive the power of a relationship compared to how the people in the relationship feel it. Because there are several moments, I think, I can't remember the exact turn of phrase, but where Frank feels a sort of an affront to his manhood or something mm-hmm. like that. Like he really feels that certain of the ways Cleo is acting in some way sort of threatening him in his status.
Yeah.
And yet, as you say, like from the external perspective, he is the one with the money. He is the one with the property. He is the one with the citizenship, all of the things. And he has the, I guess, the capacity to attribute these or not to,
yeah.
To Cleo. So there's, you know, there's this very kind of objective sense of power, and yet Frank doesn't feel that.
No.
And I think that's a really interesting insight into the difference between the way people are perceived by society and how they feel themselves.
Yeah. I mean, Frank says at one point, Cleo says, oh, he's just being a man mm. to someone. He said, why is man always a synonym for arsehole? You know, right. He's like, he's pretty belugered throughout a lot of the novel. And I think, like, you know, this isn't, the book is not meant to be this sort of like white male redemption tour. Sure. You know, that's not what the book's about, but
that's what I was hoping for.
Yeah, exactly. But the book is, I think, like, it's about flawed people mm. making choices that are not always the healthiest.
Right. Yeah,
but it
yeah.
is not about bad people mm. or immoral people. That's yeah, not yeah. what the book is about. And I don't, and I, and Frank, for all, it's easy to, you know, some people really hate Frank, and I think some people have more compassion mm. towards him. That's up to the reader. But the truth is, like, Frank is a child of an alcoholic. Mm. Frank is someone who has alcoholism himself and doesn't know it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is struggling with his own addiction. And I would say throughout the novel, is actually really trying his best to uh-huh. be a provider. There's even that scene, it's all set up in the first chapter, actually, where he offers to buy Cleo a slice of pizza, And she says, you know, are you not just really trying to buy me, mm-hmm. you know? And he said, I'm not trying to buy you, but I don't have that many tools to show I like you.
Yeah,
offering to buy you a slice of pizza is one of the ways that men are allowed to show interest. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and like, it was kind of, and then she accepts it and he's like, see, mm-hmm. you'll take the money, but you're also throw it in my face. So it's like, it's always sticky, that dynamic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't, as the writer, ever want to land on one side. You know, uh-huh. I let the characters, it's like it's a badminton shuttle. Mm-hmm. It goes back and forth between them. The reader can decide. But for me, like, I don't side with anyone in the book. I let them just do their own thing and see what happens.
I'm interested in that question of the seven perspectives, actually. I was going to come onto it later, but you mentioned it. Because you say you write from perspectives of men, of women, of people of different ages, of people of different races. Mm-hmm. And this strikes me as like quite an unfashionable way, in a sense, to approach writing at the moment. Like, it's something which I think a lot of writers very much seek to defend as like sort of this capacity for empathy, as Zadie Smith wrote in that brilliant essay, Fascinated to Presume, in the NYRB a few years ago, that there's sort of this... you know, it is part of the writer's tool for empathy, I guess, of being able to write from all of these perspectives. But did you have a lot of or any anxiety about projecting yourself into people whose experiences in at different points in society you might not share?
Yeah, I mean, it was something I took really seriously when I was doing it. You know, I also feel that the fiction writer's job is to write not only from one's mm-hmm. own perspective. You know, I'm not a memoirist, so mm-hmm. I'm always going to be writing to some degree from an identity or perspective that's not exactly my own.
Yeah.
But of course, if you're writing from the perspective of someone who's a different race or a different gender or, you know, from a very different background, it's something, I think, to be handled with love mm-hmm. and respect. So anyone that I wrote about in this novel, you know, I had numerous people in my own life who were of those identities. Uh-huh. And it didn't make sense to me to write a book that was a sort of collection of perspectives that was entirely white and straight. Yeah, I just didn't think that was going to... It just wasn't true of mm-hmm. New York, of this time, of this particular community of people. But I thought, since I was going to have to be imagining things that I definitely hadn't lived, I had numerous people from any identity read it. Mm-hmm. First of all, that was in the very, very early drafting process. Yeah. And then I also had a sensitivity reader, which my publisher provided, read the book, to read it specifically from that perspective. Because, you know, you're always going to have blind spots as a writer. Yeah. And there are things that won't be obvious to you that could really alienate or mm-hmm. potentially hurt a reader, which I would never, ever want.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't think I did it perfectly, but I hope that it will continue to be something that's allowed in fiction. Yeah, yeah. You know,
it's funny.
It's so important.
I know there's often people kind of get quite up in arms about this idea of a sensitivity reader, but I think that must be fascinating to have your manuscript read and commented on by somebody.
I actually loved it because the reader was, they were phenomenal. They were a great reader, and there were actually very few comments, but the few comments they did make, I thought they were small changes mm-hmm. that had big impacts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I thought, like, great, you mm-hmm. know, it didn't sanitize the book at all, but it called attention. You know, the truth is, I am white, the publishing industry is very white, mm-hmm. like, called attention to things that no one else working on the novel would have noticed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or would have had truly the word sensitivities too. So I was really grateful for it. But, and I also, you know, I love writing fiction and I really enjoyed that process. Mm-hmm. And I hope that as a result, like, the book is open to a larger number of readers and that more people can find themselves in this story than if I had only written from the perspective that was the most like mine.
You talked about the you know, the group setting would not, if it would have just been like white women, it wouldn't necessarily have been typical of New York at the time.
No.
Like, let's talk about New York in 2007, 2008, which is when this takes place. Like, I guess, you know, I've only visited New York once in my life. It was actually probably around that sort of time. But the impression I got of this city was of something like incredibly vibrant, but also so draining and in many ways quite toxic for the people, particularly, I guess, the young people who are living there and trying to make their way in that city.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a joke where people say, you know, New York is hard on the body and LA is hard on the soul. But I would actually say that New York is just hard on both. You know, it really is. I moved to New York as a 15-year-old in 2004.
Okay.
So those early 2000 years in New York are kind of cast in amber for me. You know, I remember them really well. They have this sort of halcyon glow. It was the period that I fell in love with the city, and I was a teenager, so my emotions were big. You know, it was a big city. It felt like a kind of mythological place. And then my feelings as a teenager were operatic, and I fell in love with it, and then I hated it. And I, you know, it was this sort of big love affair. So I wanted to set, there were a couple of reasons I wanted to set the book. First, I set it in New York because that was the city I knew best. My new novel is set all over the world. But I really wanted to write like a kind of love letter to New York, the city that I had lived in for 15 years and really, you know, grown up in. And then I set it in the early 2000s. One was practical, which was that I wasn't really interested in having up-to-date technology in the book. I felt it took me so many years to write this novel that it would have just dated it too quickly. TikTok did not exist when I started this book. So, and then the other reason I just thought the early 2000s, because it was a time in my own life that I remember with real intensity. And it was a very, you know, it was pre the crash. It was a time where it felt like there were artists in Manhattan who had money and freedom. There were sort of really famous nightlife parties happening at that time. It was just I'm not a big fan of nostalgia, but it is fun when you're with other New Yorkers who were like kind of partying during those years, because everyone's like, do you remember Beatrice? Do you remember Rough Club? Do you remember Fish Shapes? And we're all that like indie sleaze period. And it is kind of nice to look back on it fondly, even though in the truly terrible style from that era, I look back with some of the things I wore and it was just harrowing, actually. But
we'll come on to the sort of the personal things, the personal histories, particularly of Cleo and Frank, that bring tensions into their relationship. But just sticking with New York, how much do you think it is the sort of the dynamic of the city that sort of, how much does that contribute to the tension in their relationship, but also in the lives of their friends? I think of Zoe, who's sort of Frank's half sister. And I think we won't go into too much detail, but the sort of the arc of Quentin, Cleo's best friend. Well, it seems that like something sort of fundamental about the way their lives go is warped in some way by what New York does to them.
I mean, New York is an extreme city. You know, it's extremely condensed. It's extremely expensive. You know, everything about it is just, it's the most city-ish of all the cities that can city, you know? And for me, who I feel I'm quite like a maximalist writer, you know, I like things that feel high drama and high impact, hyper-reality. New York is kind of an ideal place to set fiction because the pressure, it's a pressure cooker city. You know, you can't escape each other. You know, there's this outside forces that are keeping you together.
Yes.
You can't, the city's small. You're going to run into each other. Everyone seems to know each other when you're in a kind of certain kind of social community. And that makes, I think, for dynamic fiction. And it also, I think, you know, I'm sober, and one of the things people say is if you want to speed up your bottom, move to New York, you know, because you're just, if you have...
You're going to have to explain all of that expression.
Okay, so your bottom is what you hit before you get sober.
Gotcha, okay.
So that's, and if you want to hit your bottom faster, move to New York, because if you have an addiction, New York is going to ramp it up.
Okay, so, okay.
Like, New York is a great place if you are an addict to find like-minded people to get in a lot of trouble with.
Yes.
And it's also a great place, I think, to stop doing that, you know, to reach a breaking point. It's just a city where I think it's like it accelerates things, it speeds it up, and it amplifies them, which is something I love, but I no longer live there in some ways for a reason. You know, it was a great city to spend my 20s.
It's interesting because there are, and again without going into too much of the plot details, but there are moments where people are sort of, they get out of the city in an attempt to sort of, I guess, escape particularly this pressure cooker environment that you describe. So let's talk a little bit about Cleo and Frank's backgrounds then, because there's a moment actually, I think again quite early on, where if I remember rightly, is it Cleo that quotes a bit of Philip Larkin to Frank? And funnily enough, when I was going back through my notes, I realised that I'd also quoted a bit of Philip Larkin to myself in my notes, but from a different poem, the poem This Be the Verse, you know, they fuck you up, your mum and dad.
Yes.
Because this seems to be quite a refrain in the novel. It's a sort of for Cleo and Frank, but for pretty much everyone mm-hmm. else around them, who we get to know a little bit of their background. I say pretty much because there are some decent parents in it, but that there is this kind of, broadly speaking, the characters are where they are because of damage that was inflicted. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those things, the unconscious is incredible when you're writing. You don't always know what you're writing about until, at least for me, until I reach the end. Yes, exactly. So why did these characters all know each other? What draws them to each other? And I felt, this is a group of people who are pretty high flying. They party hard, they work hard. They're pretty obsessed with appearance. They're often very self-involved. And they're self-destructive, most of the characters in this book. And that's what creates the conflict and drama in the story.
Yeah.
Is that they, given the choice between a sort of healthy action and a self-destructive action, for the majority of the novel, people are going to choose the latter.
Yeah.
And so I realized, it became clearer and clearer as I was writing, like, why do certain characters do that? And a lot of them were escaping, this feeling of just not being loved in their childhood. Mm-hmm. And so they're just searching for love. All of these characters, they're all desperate to connect. They're almost all of them deeply lonely.
Yeah.
You watch them kind of search for love in ways that give them the exact opposite, that leave them feeling more bereft and alone than ever before. And then part of what I think is so hopeful about this novel is then you see them do something different and actually begin to connect as their authentic selves to each other. And it's, I think, really, I was really moved, when I got to that point at the end, because I was like, oh, finally, Frank says at the end of the novel, people like us, we feel that we have to tap dance for love. And I got too tired to keep tap dancing.
Yes. Yeah.
And I actually think myself, when I was writing this book was a real, like, everything in the kitchen sink kind of debut, which I think can be quite common. But I felt that I was tap dancing as a writer. Like, I can do first person, I can do third person, I can do close to that, I can do, look at this, like, love me to the reader. And I feel that I've stopped tap dancing in my own life. Like, I gave myself what I also wanted my characters to have, which was just to, like, slow down a little. And what does it look like to not have to dazzle and shine all the time, but to be seen and loved for just the simple, the you that isn't a performance always.
Yeah. I've been thinking, and I haven't come to any sort of conclusion or any kind of pop analysis about it. But, like, one thing I think that's fascinating about the situation with Cleo and Frank is the presence or lack of presence of mothers in their lives.
Yeah.
So concerning Cleo's mother, I'm just trying to think, is it too much of a spoiler to talk about
this? I guess just go for it. The book's been out for a while.
Okay, so Cleo's mother committed suicide.
Yes.
So there's this kind of this very tangible absence of a mother in her life, whereas Frank's mother was very present to an extent in his childhood, but withheld her. So she was physically, tangibly present, but kind of withheld her love, and indeed was quite often quite cruel to Frank. And as I say, I haven't quite come to any sort of conclusion about the way these two sort of different relationships of the mother perhaps drew the characters together. But I was wondering if that was something that you had reflected upon, these kind of the different way these kind of quote unquote absent mothers impacted Cleo and Frank.
Yeah, I definitely think there was, I always wanted this feeling of this kind of like these orphaned people, even if they weren't literally orphaned, because it heightens the intensity of when they connect with each other. There's that feeling of two kind of adrift, shipwrecked people grasping onto each other to save each other's lives. And I think with someone like Cleo, like that, that's such an incredibly deep wound to carry with you. And it's something that she doesn't immediately reveal. And I think when someone has taken their own life, even though her mother was mentally ill, and, it very clearly, I think you can see, wasn't about Cleo, the feeling of somehow personal culpability, or had I been better, had I done something different, perhaps this wouldn't have happened, can be torturous for the child. And for Frank, although his mother is still alive, as you said, because she had a drinking problem and was very withholding and often very critical, it's that same feeling of maybe if I was better, she would stop drinking. Maybe if I was good, she would love me. So they both have that. And I think there's something... It makes so much of where we, I think, work out our childhood pain is in romantic relationships.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
that's...
Yeah.
I'm, you know... It's very buzzy now, but I'm a big believer in attachment style. And your attachment style is basically set by the time you're 2 years old, you know? And your attachment style is all about who you're attracted to in your romantic relationship.
Yeah.
So for me, it makes a lot of sense that someone like Cleo and someone like Frank would move towards each other, these two wounded people, desperate to be loved and healed. And those are the kind of people who want accelerated and intense intimacy off the bat.
Yeah.
So they get married within 6 months of meeting each other. How many people are willing to do that if they come from secure and loving families? You know, how many people want to move that fast with anyone? For a lot of people who come from stable love, that's a bit of a warning sign. But if you don't and you are so hungry, famished to feel love, that kind of speed is just absolutely, you know, mother's milk to them. You know, they just want to inhale each other. And you can feel that from the first time they meet each other. For me, that's the first half of the novel is pacey as a result, because, you know, they're moving quickly and the relationship, I think, peaks and then starts to fall apart very fast.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that falling apart again, without going into too much detail for people who haven't yet read the book. But there is a moment where I guess it's a kind of quite a climactic argument between Cleo and Frank. And again, rather than going into details, I'd like to talk a little bit about the writing of it, because I can't think of another example in a book that really captures the kind of the intractability of an argument between a couple that sort of, you know, you can have, I think, you can have very healthy arguments in relationships that don't go down this particular path.
This is not one of those healthy arguments.
This is not one of those. But I think we all probably, to an extent, maybe not quite to the intensity of the argument in this book, but we all recognize that moment when almost nothing either of the other one can say will do any good, and everything they say will do some sort of damage. And I'm just, again, I suppose from a sort of a craft perspective, really fascinated to hear you reflect on the experience of writing that particular scene and sort of and capturing that dynamic. Was it something that came sort of quite naturally? Did it come in kind of an explosion of inspiration, or was it something that really had to be sort of, I guess, precision engineered on the page?
Yeah, it's funny. Readers often bring up this fight scene. They're kind of, Frank and Cleo are sort of like funhouse mirrors. You know, they are mirrors to the reader in many ways, but they're just often distorted and extreme mirrors.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I think everyone can identify with having a fight in which you say something truly cruel to another, you know, in which you're really trying to hurt and wound, and you can't take it back and you wish that you could. Frank and Cleo take that to a real extreme, I would say, where they just say everything they can think of.
Well, not even that. There's that moment, which I think is captured really well, of kind of, you know you're about to say it and you don't want to, and yet you can't stop yourself.
They can't. You know, they're just at the top of the roller coaster and then they just go down. And, you know, technically when I was writing that scene, I really love writing dialogue. And I find that once I'm in dialogue, it has its own engine and it just goes. And that's, as someone who writes quite slowly, it's very pleasurable to have momentum behind me for certain scenes. So I wrote that scene almost like a script, just back and forth between the two of them, because, you know, arguments are quick and you're defending yourself and I wanted to capture that. So I wrote it fairly quickly, that part. And then I went back and I was trying to add in moment beats where, you know, we're back in the surroundings, where perhaps there are those moments of pause where they're reflecting on whether or not they actually want to say that, where you're getting tiny moments of interiority. And, you know, the setting for that fight is this cabin upstate in the woods. And I wanted to take them out. It's like a horror film. It is sort of psychological
when
horror.
You put
what's
it
happened.
Like that.
A cabin in the woods. But I wanted to put them in a place. One of the jokes is that neither of them can drive. Mm-hmm. You know, they're both these like city people, you know, and neither of them can cook. So they're only eating cereal for dinner. And they had been in this cabin right before they decided to get married. Mm-hmm. So there's this memory, and it's described as sort of like, you know, running almost like a river beneath the surface of every day. Mm. Is the memory of 6 months or 9 months earlier when they were there in the summer and they were falling in love. Mm-hmm. And here, such a short period of time later, here they are ultimately sort of trying to destroy the relationship and each other. And it's fun, you know, in my... I am someone who's very conflict averse in terms of my own life. So I have a very hard time sometimes with characters. I avoid the conflict and I have them just do the nice thing, and it makes for very boring scenes. And so I really, when I was writing this scene, I had actually just met the person I married, my husband, and I was like really falling in love, and I was in a really healthy love for the first time in my life. And I was having this really beautiful kind of honeyed experience of meeting this wonderful, secure, kind, steady man.
Yeah.
And I would go to the library every day, and then I would write this vicious fight scene that was like two raccoons that had been shaken up in a garbage bag and then thrown at each other. And so it was painful.
Terrifying.
Yes, exactly. And it was so it really, I was really right having to, I was pulling up memories from my past, you know, fights that I've had, but I was not in that place in my own life. So it was, I used to feel, you know, I would get out of the library in the evening and I would feel so drained by doing it. It was painful to watch. I love my characters and I hate seeing them hurt themselves and each other.
Yeah.
But it was true. You know, that's the thing sometimes, like, you can just feel with a character when, like, that is how they would have dealt with this.
Yeah.
You know, not have, you know, the tools to deal with conflict better than this, to find a way out of a relationship in a way that wasn't burning it to the ground first.
Yeah. You know, I have a policy in when I'm interviewing a writer to, you know, I'm interested in the book. I talk about the book. I don't ask questions about the personal life because it's not part of the conversation. But the question I have going around in my head now is, when did you show your husband these scenes? Which I don't want you to answer, but that is just sort of speculation of kind of like...
I know, he did. He read everything really early on. He's very, I think it's like, because he's such an incredibly secure individual, it never freaked him out. He always loves it.
I guess one of the questions that's kind of at the heart of the book is the question, I suppose it's a double barrel question of, can a person change and should they change for somebody else? Mm. And again, you know, a lot of this interview is going to be sort of skating around details of the book without spoiling too much. But it seems to me that this is the question that, particularly at the relationship at the book's heart, but also with a lot of the characters around them, is that question of, can they change? And if so, should they do it for the person, at somebody else's request, I guess.
I'm glad you think that's the question at the heart of the book, because I agree. I think it is too. And, you know, it's, I do sometimes talk about personal details from my life because it's very relevant to how I was writing it. But I got sober while writing the novel.
Okay.
So I changed in a very deep way.
Yeah.
You know, it was a profound life change. And I think when I started writing the book, one, I didn't think that Frank had a drinking problem. So joke's on me, because... But I think I probably would have thought no, you know, when I started writing the book. But I changed.
Yeah,
and
then
as a result, I think... my characters do change in really kind of seismic, fundamental ways.
Yeah.
But I don't think they change for each other.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think ultimately the change can't happen on someone else's timeline. It can't happen at someone else's bequest. You know, no matter how kindly conceived that desire for another person to change is,
it
has to come from within them. And ultimately both Cleo and Frank, and also the ancillary characters who also have their own arcs where they change as well, something has to kind of give in them that they, you know, ultimately the fear of change has to be outweighed by the desire to get out of pain.
Yeah.
You know, at a certain point, things become too painful.
Uh-huh.
And you think, actually, as scary as it is to do things differently, as much as I don't know how even, I must try in order to live, in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And this book is really about people finding ways to carry on living.
Uh-huh.
You know, what does it mean to live in the wake of... you know, pretty, I would say, like, devastating destruction to each other in their personal lives.
Yeah. One of them, I guess, potential avenue for continuing living comes from a very minor character in the book. I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce his name rightly. Jiro. Who at a moment says to Zoe, who we've mentioned earlier, he says, "You want to know what the key to a happy life is? No expectations, no preferences. If you prefer one outcome over another in life, you will likely be disappointed. I prefer nothing and I'm always surprised."
Mm.
And when reading that, I had two reactions, which was, that sounds incredibly wise, and that sounds completely unrealistic.
Yes.
And I recognise that's not really a question, but I was just going to, I suppose, I'd like to know how you see that this philosophy impacting or not, I guess, on the lives of your characters.
Well, it's Jiro is, I don't think it's a spoiler, but Jiro is someone who, Zoe decides to become a sugar baby and she goes on a date with this Japanese businessman, Jiro. And I think, I find expectations very important as a writer, because the great joy of my life is trying to work out how to upend expectations and thwart them, or in a way that is hopefully, you know, delightful or disturbing. And so that exact scene is an example of that. You know, what would you expect from a date between a 19-year-old and an older businessman who is her sugar daddy? Maybe something slightly lecherous, lascivious, you know, like, and what ends up happening is they have this incredibly soulful, sort of spiritual discussion in which Jiro is really sensitive and imparts, you know, I think a lot of wisdom onto Zoe, and is very curious and interested in her life and in her, you know, she's at the beginning of so much. Yeah, he's very respectful of that in her. So I know it's, like, expectations are so important to me, because I'm thinking all the time, like, what would you expect from this? What can I do that's almost the opposite of that or different to that? Because for me, that's what creates dynamic scene. But I think he's right. And I think Zoe even says the next thing, she's like, are you Buddhist or something? Because she was just, and he was like, no. Like, but she's sort of incredulous. Like, because she says, what, surely if you had the choice between me kissing you or punching you, you would choose me kissing you. And he says, well, what if you kiss me and give me a cold sore? And what if you punch me and give me a new perspective on pain? And so it's just someone who comes in and you know, I it's always interesting, that happens often in my own life, where I meet someone and they just shift the perspective on something in a way I couldn't expect. And it's fun to have a character like Jiro, who is, you know, a true side character in some ways, but I think a very, like, potent character, because he comes in and he completely sort of changes Zoe's life. Miraculously, I have a new job. It's a freelance gig at an ad agency as a copywriter. My contract is for 3 months with the option to extend. They call this temp to perm. I love this phrase. Not only is it palindrome adjacent, it is extremely useful. All situations in life fall into one of these two categories. For example, the fact you are 37 years old and currently live with your mother in New Jersey, I remind myself, is temp. But the shape of your chin is sadly perm. Until recently, I was living in LA, working in the writer's room of a show about a clairvoyant cat. But due to creative differences, I made my departure. In fact, I was departed. The exact words they used were invited to leave. Not even the cat saw it coming. To hell with it, I'm relieved to leave LA, that sinkhole of creative ambition masquerading as an industry town. At least in Fairlawn, New Jersey, the first question posed isn't always TV or film, like getting our still or sparkling at a restaurant. I'm being shown around the office by Jackie, the creative director's assistant. She's in her 50s with a poof of blonde hair and large blue eyes, lined disconcertingly in more blue. Jackie is like a poodle in that her fluffy exterior belies a keen and cunning intelligence. No, she says when she sees where I'm sitting. Nuh-uh, we're not keeping you here. She leans over the desk and taps numbers into her phone with practiced efficiency. Raul, hi hon, it's Jackie. I'm gonna need you to help me move a new hire. We have her at the wrong desk. Yep, see you in a few. Thanks, gorgeous. She hangs up and turns to me. Is there something wrong with this desk? I ask. You're our only female writer, she says, and an actual adult. You're not sitting in the boondocks with the intern. The only object on my desk when I arrive is a mug that says, always do what you love. It goes straight into a drawer. My mother is picking fresh mint from the garden for tea when I get home. Her mugs have different bird species painted onto them. Her favorite is the goldfinch. She gives me the red cardinal. She only gives the blackbird to people she doesn't like. We kill an evening watching Sing Your Heart Out, a singing competition that seems to demand that the singers have endured a life hardship, ranging from the very bad, a dead parent or leukemia, to the kind of sad, a dead grandparent or hoarding, to the really stretching it, a dead pet or mono. The contestants take turns tearfully recounting their stories in front of a wall advertising an energy drink. "What would you sing?" asks my mother. "I don't know," I say. "Something about being a woman? You?" "Oh, some sexy pop song," she says. "Really give him a show." My mother's living room has two sofas, the eating couch and the visitor's couch. An essay I wrote about nature in the fifth grade hangs on the wall. She said she knew I was a sensitive child when she read the first line. "The park is a place of exquisite beauty and extreme danger."
There's another character that I'd like to speak about, and again, avoiding spoilers, but it's Eleanor. And,
oh, yeah.
And one of the reasons, just from a kind of, again, a writing perspective, that Eleanor is interesting is that she is the only person, the only character in the novel who's expressed in the first person.
Mm-hmm.
And this, as I was reading, it gave me a real jolt as a reader to suddenly be in Eleanor's thoughts and to suddenly be, to be with her. And she's, you know, a little bit exterior to this mm-hmm. group. You know, she's not so much part of the web of sort of friends and associates as all of the others. So could you just talk a little bit about the decision to, you know, as you said, you play with different sort of closeness of third person perspective with other positions, but it's always very firmly third person. What was it about Eleanor and her role in the story or her character that made you want to write in her voice?
When I talk, you know, Eleanor has become the kind of like secret star of the novel. Uh-huh. She's a real fan favorite, I have to say.
My favorite character.
Oh, really? Okay, great. That's cool. I also love Eleanor and I loved writing her sections. And retrospectively, I always have like a really good reason for why I wrote her in first person, which is that I don't think it ruins anything to say that within the novel, she's within the archetype of the other woman.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of role that she would play. And I think since, you know, and I would expect that any reader would come, we're very invested in Cleo and Frank at that point. So there's going to be a lot of pushback against the introduction of a third person mm-hmm. into the relationship. So I wanted to do my best to, again, upend that or question right. that by having us be really close to her. You know, we can't judge her because we are her. We're first person with her. And it's a kind of, it's a forced empathy, first person.
Right.
And so that, in some ways, that was one of the reasons. But actually, the true reason when I was writing the book is that I'd been working on it for years. And I wanted to give my hand at first person. And I clearly never thought I was going to write another novel because I was just like, anything I ever want to do, I have to do it in this book.
Tell me about it.
I thought I just wanted to try it, you know, and I wanted to write first person fragment. I really wanted to try writing funny.
Mm-hmm.
I felt in my own life, when I tell stories, I often try to make them funny. But the novel, it is funny, I think, at times, but it doesn't quite have that really punchline-y humor.
Yeah.
And that first-person fragment is very bouncy, you know?
Yeah,
and it's
it
is like a punchline. So it was really fun to write. And I had, you know, I had all these notes from all my years of being a copywriter, things I had written down that I'd found funny. And it was like a magpie creating a nest of just shiny things. And I gave them all to Eleanor. And, you know, she lives in New Jersey with her mother. She's in her 30s. She's actually much closer to Frank's age than Cleo's. She's not, on the surface, glamorous the way the other characters are. She's not as shiny, you know. But she is, for me, like, she is shiny because just, I hope, a delight to read. And she's a very funny relationship with her mother.
Yes.
She's also grieving her father. And I was really interested in how we use humor to hide sadness.
Mm-hmm.
And this book is all about balance between dark and light, gravity and levity, you know, freedom and the feeling of being, you know, very unfree inside of ourselves.
Yeah.
And she's part of that balance. You know, there's this kind of glimmering city and then there's her in New Jersey and it's this other side of the river. And also she's this kind of perfect mixture for me of just like, of real sadness and real joy, and she's both all the time.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. I think firstly concerning the reasons for doing something. You mentioned the unconscious a few times, and I think it's definitely something which, you know, you say writers don't really always know what they're doing at the time, and the post factum reasons, even if you didn't think that at the time, are as legitimate as the reasons for doing it, which is just, as you said, you wanted a break, you wanted a change.
Yeah.
But in fact, you know, I think the kind of the weird alchemy of composition means that, your brain works in very strange ways and takes you in certain directions, which, you only understand several months or several years later. But I thought also as a reader concerning the first person perspective, what it did for me as well was in some way its effect sort of spread out onto the other characters. So there, I think by certain points I was getting sort of like quite annoyed with Cleo and Frank and all Fair. The people are, and like, and this is interesting to say, like I was getting annoyed with them as people while not getting annoyed with the book, which I think is something which is an interesting effect, you know.
They can be very frustrating
and a testament to your writing as well. But then suddenly when you're confronted with this first person perspective, I think it sort of spreads out. It allows you to suddenly realize that there's all these other first person perspectives which are going on and are bubbling sort of under the surface that you've been sort of denied access to until this point. And so I felt that it had a kind of a softening effect on my opinions of some of the actions and sort of reactions of the other characters.
I'm glad to hear that, because I also think, you know, there's a self-awareness to Eleanor that is lacking in a lot of the other characters, and I think she brings an element of self-awareness to the book.
Yeah.
So, because I think after a while, you know, you're reading these characters and so many of their problems are of their own making, which, you know, I have, you know, is common and I have compassion for, but ultimately, you know, can be extremely frustrating when you're like, you truly sort of have everything. Life could be really easy, but you haven't gone to therapy and therefore you are making your life extremely hard.
That's a lesson in the book. Go to therapy.
It kind of is. But, whereas Eleanor, you know, she sees these characters so clearly and, you know, she often comments on them. Mm. And it also lets the reader know, I think, that me as the writer is aware, you know,
right.
like
okay.
I also
yeah, yeah.
see, because Eleanor, you know, I've written Cleo, Frank, but I've also written Eleanor, you know, and so it's like whoever can write all of those people obviously knows, you know, that I'm not, you know, obtuse to the fact that someone like Cleo can be grating in some ways, you know, she comes like dangerously close, I think, to like a manic pixie dream girl, and I hope like pulls back from that.
No, I don't.
It's a trope that she is playing, you know, that's part of the allure of her. Mm-hmm. That's part of what Frank sees in her early on. So when we see Eleanor react to Cleo, it's really interesting to get a perspective that isn't in this very insular bubble of kind of like cool New Yorkers.
Where I'd like to finish, because we are almost out of time, is with like, I've got a sense while reading the book and definitely in a sense while talking to you that you know these characters. Like these characters are very real to you. and why I think they become very real to us as readers. Have they continued to live for you after the book? Like, do you have a sense that sort of like, you know, how their lives have gone on, what they're doing now, even perhaps if you'll ever revisit some of them in the future? Or is it, as I've had writers tell me in the past, like however living they are on the page, once the final full stop is there, that's it, they're done.
They are still alive to me. I'm so glad they feel alive to you, because a character's kind of everything for me. Like, that's all a novel is for me. Mm. You know, I'm not that interested in anything other than character. So sometimes to the detriment of the book.
But just to be clear, there is definitely plot.
There's definitely plot in this book. It took a while to get there. There's definitely plot. But no, I mean, it's funny. I was having dinner in Paris the other day and someone walked into the restaurant and I was like, Zoe. And she just looked exactly like I imagined Zoe looking. And that makes me so happy whenever I see that. And I get asked a lot if I'm going to write a sequel for this book, because the ending is also a beginning. You know, there's nothing permanent about the end. Mm-hmm. You know, that no one dies. You know, like everyone's... I don't think that's like a will they, won't they in the novel. I don't think anyone's like, who will die in this book? And many of them are just beginning these like whole new chapters in their lives. So there's a real, I think it's very hopeful for that reason. I wasn't interested in writing a sequel. My new novel is with a completely new set of characters that just like absolutely took me captive and I had no choice but to follow them into their lives. But I am working on the TV show for this book, which I think will be, it's very visual, this novel, and it's you know, rich in terms of its setting. And it has this ensemble cast, you know, that's built in. So for me, that would be a really natural way of continuing to tell their stories, because I have a lot of thoughts on what happens to someone like Quentin, who is, of all the characters, I think, left in maybe sometime the most worrying place in some ways. And Zoe's only 19. She's got, they've got a lot of life left to live. They've got a lot of love to... is this a Cher? Am I, do you believe in love after love? I'm like, is this, I'm like, am I? But I do believe in love after love. So.
Which I think is a perfect place, a bit of Cher to finish the conversation. Cleopatra and Frankenstein is of course available from Shakespeare and Company. We have this ongoing joke that every time Coco visits us, we've actually sold out of the book. But generally, it's available from Shakespeare and Company, from our bricks and mortar store, from the from our online shop, or of course from your local independent bookstore, wherever you are based. Coco, it's been such fun. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation, it would be great if you could help us spread the word by reviewing or rating us in your favourite app, or just by sending the link to your friends. And don't forget, if you'd like even more from Shakespeare & Company, you can subscribe now through Apple Podcasts or Patreon for just €3 a month. Links to both are available in the show notes to this episode. Production of this podcast is all done in-house here at Shakespeare & Company Paris. All music is by Alex Fryman, whose album, Play It Gentle, is available to buy or stream wherever you listen. We'll be back soon. Until then, take care, and thanks again for listening.